from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in Forum's opening hour this morning, last week WikiLeaks distributed more than 250,000 classified embassy cables to newspapers around the globe that provide an unvarnished view of U.S. foreign policy. And while proponents of WikiLeaks and its founder, Julian Assange, herald the release of the documents as a victory for free speech and open information, critics contend that the release of the private correspondence undermines national security. And the plot continues to thicken. Assange has recently been charged with allegations of sex crimes in Sweden and is presently imprisoned in the United Kingdom. There have been calls for his prosecution under the Espionage Act. Supporters have responded by organizing a campaign of cyber attacks. We'll talk about it all in the hour ahead. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Since the release of confidential cables by WikiLeaks, an increasing number of service providers have distanced themselves, including Amazon.com, PayPal, Visa, and MasterCard, and those sites have been a target of many DOS denial-of-service attacks designed to keep visitors from getting through. Connecticut Senator Joseph Lieberman, who heads the Homeland Security Committee, said just last week that no responsible company should assist WikiLeaks in its efforts to disseminate stolen materials. And one congressional representative wants WikiLeaks to be designated as a terrorist organization, while a variety of First Amendment defenders and supporters of WikiLeaks head Julian Assange continue to defend the organization and its chief spokesman. Where do you stand? Well, in this morning's opening forum hour, we want to focus our attention once again on the ongoing WikiLeaks controversy and drama as it continues to unfold. With us in studio is Kevin Bankston, who is senior staff attorney for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Good morning.
Good morning.
And also with us in studio this morning is Declan McCullough, who is chief political correspondent for CNET. Welcome.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning to you. Niles Gardner joins us this morning from the nation's capital. He's a director of the Margaret Thatcher Center for Freedom with the Heritage Foundation. And welcome, Niles Gardner.
Good morning.
Glad to have you all aboard. Actually, let me begin, Declan, with you. It's in some ways ironic that Assange has become such a central figure because I think when you met him back in the 90s, things were supposed to be anonymous and all identities were supposed to be anonymous. Now he's taken cover of Time magazine, in fact.
The philosophical underpinnings for WikiLeaks started in the 1990s on discussions on the Cypherpunks list, which was actually hosted by EFF, this is Kevin's organization's co-founder, John Gilmore. And the discussions were about how to use new technologies, digital cash, anonymous remailers, anonymous publishing systems to get documents out that the government didn't want to appear. Back then, it was the Church of Scientology that didn't want to appear. And when WikiLeaks was created in 2006, it was anonymous. The founders were anonymous. Julian Assange was the Australian kind of regional director for that area. And everyone else more or less remained anonymous for fear of retribution. But Julian decided to become very public. And I think now he might be rethinking the wisdom of becoming such a figurehead.
Well, he's become a figurehead who also the cyber attackers are defending, even to the point of going after these young Swedish women who have charged him with sexual molestation or sexual assault, which is why he's in jail now. He has surrendered himself to authorities in the UK. Well, sounds very much like a Stieg Larsson novel or something, I was thinking. But from the perspective of what this cyber attack represents at this point, going after the multinationals and going after particularly companies like MasterCard and so forth, this is pretty well organized.
It's reasonably well organized. But let's remember the cyber attacks have been flowing on both sides. So WikiLeaks said, this was a week and a half ago that Sunday, that we're preparing to release these documents later in the day. And they did, or a slow trickle. And as soon as they announced that the documents were forthcoming, then they were targeted by a cyber attack. And so that was kind of an anti-WikiLeaks cyber attack trying to overwhelm their servers. And now we're seeing the cyber attacks going the other direction. Distributed denial of service attacks are hitting. Yesterday morning, it was MasterCard. Yesterday afternoon, it was Visa. They're being coordinated by a group of sort of vigilante hackers named Anonymous. Facebook yanked down a page that they were using to coordinate attacks yesterday. That Twitter yanked their account, then it was restored, or a similar one is being used. So this is a fast-moving sort of series of developments.
And it's not something, Kevin Bankson, that the EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, countenances. You're not in favor of this kind of vigilantism.
I don't think EFF condones cyber vigilantism of any stripe, whether it's to take down MasterCard or to take down WikiLeaks itself. I think the answer to speech you disagree with is more speech, not distributed denial of service attacks. But to bring this back to the broader question of WikiLeaks and what it does, I think that regardless of whether you or I or anyone else thinks that what WikiLeaks does is responsible or irresponsible or good for U.S. democracy or bad for it or journalistic or terroristic, and I think there's room for a wide range of opinions there, the one simple fact remains that based on longstanding precedent, our First Amendment very strongly protects the rights of WikiLeaks and the New York Times and you and I to publish and read this information. And the burden is not on the publisher to demonstrate that these cables are newsworthy. Rather, it's the burden of the government to demonstrate that particular information in particular cables is going to cause significant irreparable harm to the national security.
When you say the burden, you mean the burden of proof, and it's a high standard.
It is a very high standard, and the Supreme Court has called it an interest of the government must demonstrate an interest of the highest order and must show imminent, serious, specific national security harm if it wants to restrain publication and likely if it wanted to prosecute someone for publishing this information.
But you've also said that you're disappointed by the companies that have decided they're unwilling or afraid to do business with WikiLeaks. And this is because WikiLeaks, from your perspective, is protected under the First Amendment entirely and conclusively.
Well, I think that the speech that the information that WikiLeaks is publishing is protected by the First Amendment and very strongly. And although these companies are within their legal rights to decide who to do business with and what speech they support or do not, it raises the serious problem that in today's internet-worked society, our free speech rights, which are enshrined in law and have been for quite a long time, are wholly dependent on these intermediaries to the extent that our free speech rights are really only as strong as the weakest intermediary. And so we would like to see, particularly considering we are talking about core free speech rights, more companies willing to stand up and be brave in the face of criticism from Senator Joe Lieberman or in the face of calls to assassinate the founder of WikiLeaks and enable Americans to publish and read this information, whether it's being published by WikiLeaks or the New York Times or Der Spiegel or anyone else.
Kevin Bankson, again, a senior staff attorney for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Let me just ask you, Kevin, to trace a little bit for us specifically precedent here from a legal standpoint. We've got the Pentagon Papers, and we also have, a case that I think you were involved in, were you? Bartnicki versus Vopper?
Oh, admittedly, that case was a bit before my time, but I think it's a very important one along with and following the Pentagon Papers case, where many of your listeners may know, the Supreme Court struck down a prior restraint on the New York Times and the Washington Post against publishing classified documents regarding the Vietnam War, saying that the government had failed to meet this very heavy burden. Bartnicki is another interesting case, Bartnicki v. Vopper from 2001, that involved a wiretap. Someone illegally intercepted a cell phone call between union representatives discussing a contentious labor dispute. And that was shared with a radio commentator who knew that obviously that it was intercepted but had nothing to do with the interception. And he played that recording on the radio. And one of the parties to the call sued him under the wiretap statute, which is also a criminal statute. And the Supreme Court said, you can't do that. That to punish the publication of true or political speech based only on the fact that someone passively received the information and didn't have anything to do with the wrongdoing that created it would chill an enormous amount of valuable protected First Amendment speech. And so I think that's fairly directly analogous to what's going on here, where we are talking about, in the form of WikiLeaks and the New York Times, organizations that claim that they did not solicit this information from Bradley Manning, the private who allegedly obtained it all, but rather that it was given to them and they are merely receiving it, and publishing it.
And Bradley Manning, who the Berkeley City Council has nominated for heroism, by the way, and to give some kind of medal, is not above the law here where the First Amendment is concerned and can be prosecuted. There's nothing to protect him as far as First Amendment rights.
I think a First Amendment argument for Mr. Manning would be much more difficult considering, unlike you or I or the New York Times or WikiLeaks, he did have agreements with the government to keep things secret. And so I think that is going to be an issue that Mr. Manning's counsel will have to deal with. But our focus right now is on the right to publish these documents now that they have been leaked.
Let me go to you, Niles Gardner. Niles Gardner with us from Washington, directs the Margaret Thatcher Center for Freedom for the Heritage Foundation. And I know you see WikiLeaks as being damaging to the United States and making diplomacy difficult and reducing effectiveness for American statesmanship and statecraft. But what about the First Amendment argument?
Well, I think you're dealing with highly sensitive documents that have been released worldwide. Some of this material, I think, is very damaging in terms of harm to American national security. And after all, we've seen documents released that have named critically important sites in Britain and across Europe that are vital for U.S. National interests. Some of this material that has been released, I think, can ultimately threaten the national security of America, as well as the national security of key allies. I don't see this as some sort of, First Amendment question. What WikiLeaks has done is hugely irresponsible. In my view, it's illegal. And the United States should take whatever action it can do so in order to prosecute those responsible, including Julian Assange. But, of course, it's a highly complicated legal process.
And, you're going to have to get you'd have to get him on U.S. soil, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I think that, a key question is if the United States decides to go ahead and prosecute Assange, key question is whether, for example, British authorities would be prepared to extradite him to the United States. I think they probably would be prepared to do so. If he goes to Sweden, of course, to face trial and other charges, that makes the process more complicated. The extradition treaty between Sweden and the United States, I think, is certainly less favorable for the U.S. side. It would be harder to have Assange extradited from Sweden. But I do think, in the case of Great Britain, there would be certainly strong political momentum for having Assange extradited to face trial in the United States. After all, Britain has been heavily targeted as well as a result of the fallout from WikiLeaks. I think Britain has been damaged. British diplomatic interests have been harmed as a result of the release. And so I think there is a common interest on both sides of the Atlantic to see justice done here.
Well, when you mention national security, those who have defended Assange and the WikiLeaks leaking of documents say that, again, we heard this to some extent from Kevin Bankston, the burden of proof is on the government to and it has. In fact, Julian Assange himself said at this point there has been nothing that he knows of or no evidence that he knows of putting any diplomats' lives at risk or any contacts' lives at risk, nothing demonstrable along those lines.
Well, there's absolutely no way, I think, that Mr. Assange could make that kind of judgment. What we do have, of course, is the are the identities of a large number of individuals, diplomats, sources, for example, that have been released. This information can be used by terrorist organizations. There's no doubt about it, I think, that the WikiLeaks debacle is very damaging for American national security and could threaten the lives of individuals who either work for the U.S. government or who supply important information to the U.S. government. And that's why this kind of information deserves to be kept confidential in order to protect those individuals who are either working for the United States or who are supplying important sensitive information to America.
I know there are many listeners who want to weigh in on this. It's certainly not only highly controversial, but it inflames a lot of emotions. Let me open the phone lines now and give you an opportunity to call us and to not only perhaps reflect on what your thoughts are on this or your emotions, but also raise any questions that you have. Our toll-free number is available whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your phone calls and you can call us now. Again, it's toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also, of course, send us an email to forum@kqed.org, or you can post a question or comment on our website simply by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. And Kevin Bankson, you want to say something in response to what you heard from Niles Gardner?
Yes. When we're talking about potential harm, and I highlight potential harm from the release of these documents, I think a few facts are helpful. First off, we're talking about many documents, a quarter of a million documents, over half of which are not classified in any sense at all, and only 6% of which are classified secret, and none of which are classified as top secret. I think we are talking about documents that over 3 million people have official access to. And so I think that the idea that our enemies don't have a great deal of this information already is somewhat naive.
Let me ask Niles Gardner about that, because many informed people have said from all sides of the political spectrum that there isn't that much that's really new in terms of what WikiLeaks, what has been revelatory about WikiLeaks, although I think you feel differently about that, Mr. Gardner.
I think there is a great deal of new material out there, and we've perhaps only seen part of the material that is due to be released as well. There's no doubt about it. I think a lot of the information contained in these WikiLeaks documents, or government documents leaked by WikiLeaks, are extremely important. And I do believe that if you are providing this sort of information on a plate, which can be used by terrorist organizations with access to these documents on the internet, I think you're doing terrorists a huge favor by leaking these documents. It's highly irresponsible. And there's no doubt about it. I think that, careless talk costs lives, basically.
There is a listing, in fact, in one of the diplomatic cables of all of the places that are considered most vulnerable and in need of protection. It's almost as if, as you're suggesting, I believe one could infer from that terrorists are sort of being given a laundry list of places that the United States considers particularly important to protect. Let me go back for a moment, Declan McCullough, to you. In fact, speaking about threats, Julian Assange, I believe, has talked about this poison pill, some kind of encryption that he will release if anything happens to him or if he's prosecuted to the fullest maximum law. What do we know about this?
Right. It's a 1.2 gigabyte encrypted file using AES, a 256-bit key, which is pretty much unbreakable given what we know about the state of encryption. And so the only way we'll find out for sure what's in it is if he releases the passphrase. With that passphrase, then anyone who has a copy can decrypt it. And, of course, there's... it's been published on WikiLeaks.org and other websites since August, and so a lot of people have copies of this. Assange said 100,000, which sounds about right. I mean, downloading a file, sticking it on your hard drive just in case the secret magic passphrase is ever revealed is kind of an interesting idea. We don't know what's in it. There are some hints that it would be information that would be especially embarrassing to the U.S. It could be things like the rest of the cables. That doesn't take 1.2 gigabytes. It could be things including the names of U.S. intelligence operatives, which would be very damaging. The British intelligence agencies were very upset when even a list of 100 of their names were published publicly a few years ago. So this is a pretty clever mechanism to get information out there, and it's sort of this last ditch defense.
But in terms of what it has, we're really in the land of speculation entirely here.
Mostly speculation.
Yeah. Let me go to our callers, and Mary, you're up first. Join us, please. Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say that my daughter is a Foreign Service diplomat, and although her name has not appeared on any of the listings that I have seen so far, it certainly could. And if anyone is keeping track of that, then she's an easy target. They can't protect every single foreign diplomat that works in the third world countries or second world countries or even, France or England to the level that they would need to if terrorists do decide to target these folks. I mean, part of their job is to get information about the countries and report back to Hillary Clinton or the State Department and the State Department about what they see going on, so that the State Department has information that they can work with that's the best possible. They're not spying. They're just observing.
Let me ask Kevin Bankston about that. That sense, again, the burden of proof is big, as you said, but the vulnerability of operatives and naming names and so forth can't be discounted here.
Well, I think it's worth pointing out that these same worries cropped up a few months ago when it came to the Iraq and Afghan war logs released by WikiLeaks. These same concerns were brought up when the Pentagon Papers were published nigh on 40 years ago. And those worried results, the worried harm to individuals, never materialized. And I certainly thank the caller, or rather the caller's daughter, for her service to our country. And I, no more than anyone, wants to see harm come to her or any other U.S. Official. But I do think that the bargain we've made as a country, the bargain that our founders made, is one that disfavors authoritarian control of speech and favors a free press. And although, as Justice Learned Hand said long ago, although many will always find that to be folly, it is the bargain on which we've staked everything. And we cannot let concerns about general security override that. And rather, we have to put the government to the test and demand that if it wants to restrain speech, it picks out the particular information that's going to cause particular serious harm to the United States.
But Kevin, the government has restrained speech. I'm generally with you on these points, but let's point out the actual law. And there's the Espionage Act that's been around roughly 100 years, and it makes it illegal, a federal crime, a federal felony, to disclose information, quote, relating to the national defense, as long as that information could be used, quote, to the injury of the United States. This is the law of the land. We don't have to talk about hypotheticals. That law has not been applied to journalists. And so there's one question about whether Assange and the other folks involved in WikiLeaks are journalists. But, I mean, this is the law. It seems like it's pretty clear that he violated the law. The question is whether, A, he can be brought to U.S. soil, and the second is, B, whether that law is applied to an information disseminating organization like WikiLeaks violates the First Amendment. But the law is there.
Excuse me. We're coming up on a break here, and I want to get a final word from Niles Gardner because we're going to have to say goodbye to him. We're going to be joined by Victor Davis Hanson. And Niles Gardner, actually, in fact, one of the arguments we hear from Victor Davis Hanson, or will hear, is that why didn't WikiLeaks go after, say, finding out what are in the cables of the Iranian government? Why concentrate so much on the West? Do you share that sentiment?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think WikiLeaks is an intensely anti-American organization with a specific political agenda to undermine America as a global power. And I must say I fully agree with the caller who really echoed the concerns of a very large number of people in the United States across the world who are very concerned about the security risks to individuals working for the United States, serving the country across the world, as a result of these disclosures. And, you know, we are engaged at the moment in a global war against Islamist terrorism. And these are very dangerous times. And providing all sorts of names, details, information publicly through these documents puts people at tremendous personal risk.
Niles Gardner, thank you so much for joining us. Niles Gardner, again, directs the Margaret Thatcher Center for Freedom with the Heritage Foundation. When we come back, more of your calls and emails and online postings, and Victor Davis Hanson will join us as well from Hoover. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Last week, WikiLeaks distributed over 250,000 classified embassy cables to newspapers around the world, providing a view of U.S. foreign policy that some say endangers national security. And proponents of WikiLeaks and its founder, Julian Assange, say that the release is a victory for free speech and open information. We're talking with a number of people about this issue and also talking about what has begun to be an organized campaign of cyber attacks on WikiLeaks detractors and those who have been blocking WikiLeaks from getting essentially donations and other kinds of support. We spoke earlier with Niles Gardner, who directs the Margaret Thatcher Center for Freedom for the Heritage Foundation. And with us in studio for the hour is Kevin Bankston, who is senior staff attorney for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and Declan McCullough, who is chief political correspondent for CNET. We wanted to bring Victor Davis Hanson into this also. He's senior fellow for the Hoover Institution at Stanford and author of The Father of Us All, War and History, Ancient and Modern. And welcome, Victor Davis Hanson.
Thank you for having me.
I think, glad to have you. I think, as I characterized it before, from your perspective, this is an anti-Western struggle, and it's also your title in National Review Online was Julian Assange's Ego Leaks, very much a kind of egotistical odyssey for Julian Assange.
Yeah, his targets are selective, and they're predicated in part on the level of risk to himself. He's facing some type of probably exaggerated charge that he didn't use a condom. That's the Western response if they want to get Julian Assange. If he were to leak Iranian cables or Russian cables or Chinese cables, and you could make an argument that those authoritarian governments cause more harm in the world than Western governments, then I don't think that he'd be looking at a charge of disputed sexual contact among Western women and be a lot more serious. He's the equivalent of ignore entirely radical Islam, or they don't want to print cartoons that make fun of the Prophet. Their morality is selective, and it's predicated partly on their ideology and partly on their sense of safety.
And just how dangerous is this to those in the field, in your judgment?
We don't know. I heard some of the callers say that they tried to reference the Pentagon Papers, which was very different. It was something in the past that it occurred during the Nixon administration, and the Nixon administration was actually ambiguous about it because it did not embarrassed them so much as the Kennedy and Johnson administrations, and it was a history. It was a private history of Vietnam. It did affect things, as Kissinger made the argument, that the policy was harder to conduct because there was no sense that the United States could keep secrets, but it was not ongoing private diplomatic cables. And so when we say that we don't know anybody who's killed, or Mr. Assange said that, we have 70,000 people who appear in these cables, and believe me, if one of them is shot tomorrow or killed in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, it won't be in the headlines of the New York Times, or it won't be on public radio. There's too many of them. We won't know. We'll never really know. But it's logical to assume that somebody is reading these and somebody knows some of the people who felt that their future would be better if they worked with coalition forces, and therefore that they're targets. And so we won't know the effects of it. Mr. Assange doesn't care, though. He really doesn't. He's judge, jury, and executioner of what he considers the truth. He has a strange idea that the truth is complete transparency when no institution in modern society works that way. Surely, you know, National Public Radio would not work if suddenly, as a public entity, you were obliged to put all of your private email out on decision-making and take one of your most controversial decisions to get rid of Juan Williams. Would you really want all of the email that went back and forth, pro and con, about firing Juan Williams out in front of the entire public so they could judge? In other words, in a philosophical sense, what the truth is a very complex process of self-criticism, self-critique, venting, that all is distilled down to a decision, which is true or false. But just because people have ideas, or that they have trial balloons, or that they vent, doesn't mean necessarily that they're disingenuous or they're dishonest. Somebody could have written an email in the NPR archives where he said, "I think that we got to get rid of Juan Williams because he's a blank, blank, blank," and it might not be perfectly true, and he might not have completely meant it. He just was emotional. But would you want that? NPR calls him something under private. It won't. Society doesn't work that way.
I don't think KQED was too involved in the Juan Williams imbroglio, but I understand what you're saying. And I'm also interested in what the anonymous group that has launched the cyber attack is saying and your response to them. They talk about some of the things that have been quoted, the millennial struggle to free the world from entrenched elites, and they've made comparisons to their group to, you know, lunch counter sit-ins, and they call Assange a political prisoner.
Well, you know, I'm here in the San Joaquin Valley where I have a farm, and it's the poorest section of Fresno County, which is the second poorest county in California, and I just got back from the Food for Less discount, and I saw a lot of very needy people using things like MasterCard and private credit cards, and that this whole system is based on an idea that you can extend credit and people can purchase things, and there's an online system that's viable. And when people try to destroy it in a global sense, the people are going to be hurt are the everyday person that needs access to it. And they don't seem to, again, they don't seem to care about that because they want to make a point. And they're products of the Western media and Western attention and Western fascination. But as I said earlier, there's billions of people who are suffering far more from authoritarian regimes that these people won't dare confront. And there's a lot more people who are going to suffer than Julian Assange if his adherents try to take down Internet systems of credit, finance, purchasing.
Victor Davis Hanson, again, a senior fellow with the Hoover Institution at Stanford and author of The Father of Us All, War and History, Ancient and Modern. Let's go to more of your calls. And Paula, join us. Good morning.
Good morning. You know, it's interesting to listen to this because did Nixon or Kissinger care when they financed the Pinochet regime in Chile about the lives that their objectives would cost? And I also have to disagree that Assange is anti-American. I think he's anti-establishment. And if I'm not wrong, papers and leaks on China and Russia are also, you know, in the horizon. And I have to comment that I questioned Assange's motivations or the wisdom behind WikiLeaks at first. But the more information I read from what's come out, I really have come around to think that I question who the real terrorists are, to be honest, as extreme as that sounds. And I think that we are going to really favor from transparency, especially when we get a little bit of further insight on how corporations and banks really are operating and what is they're getting away with. And I think that if that information comes ahead, we are favored. And thank you for taking my call.
Well, thank you for your remarks. What do you think, Declan McCullough, about those who are launching the cyber campaign? I mean, they've been described or characterized as anarchists, which wouldn't necessarily make them anti-Western. I mean, how would they best be characterized, in your judgment?
Well, the Economist did a nice piece about the group Anonymous earlier today, and it's kind of like the same concept between people who would dress up in all black and wear headscarves and throw rocks through the front windows of McDonald's at a protest that turn into riots almost. I mean, it's the same mentality.
Happened in Seattle?
It's with a twist, and this is it doesn't require you to really risk anything. You can download some software, participate in a denial of service attack, just follow a Twitter channel. I mean, if I were 14 years old, I mean, considering that the kind of things that I liked when I was 14, I'd probably be doing this right now. Let's not give too much credit. This could be just a bunch of 14-year-olds who really like WikiLeaks quite a bit.
Could you clarify also for us, Declan, this story that's come out of Colombia, supposedly, in fact, I'm getting a few emails on it, and I've seen some things on blogs about it, students being told if they mention WikiLeaks or refer to it in Twitter or on their Facebook page or any of those kinds of things, they'll be kept from getting State Department jobs?
Right. A little bit of clarification is in order. There were some reports last week. There was a letter that Columbia University sent around saying if you talk about, if you download, if you discuss, if you forward these classified cables, then you might not be able to get a government security clearance. And then the State Department said this week that, well, we never told Columbia that. Maybe one of our employees did, but we have a lot of employees and we don't know, and we have no position on this one way or another. The State Department has actually been pretty careful not to exaggerate things. Maybe some other federal agencies have been a little less careful. The Pentagon, for instance, has been a bit more warlike, if you pardon the expression, in the rhetoric. There's, this is classified information. If you're disclosing classified information read very strictly, you might be violating the law. So if you're setting up a WikiLeaks mirror site, be careful. This administration probably won't do anything, but a future one could.
Here's a listener, Frank, who writes, and this represents, I think, the point of view of a number of our listeners. He says, Bush Cheney tried to make all government operations secret. Obama has continued this policy. Anything that opens up the huge vault of government secrecy is a boon to the cause of freedom and democracy. The giant corporations are co-conspirators in the effort to make secrecy a way of doing business. Here's a legal thorny issue Kevin Bankson, one of our listeners, raises and says, when PayPal, Visa, and MasterCharge halt all financial services to WikiLeaks, they stop any kind of legal defense fund, denying them proper representation. While they may disagree with WikiLeaks' operations, how can they deny them the ability to collect donations to defend their rights?
Well, as I've said, we are disappointed in those companies halting their service of WikiLeaks based on what we think is First Amendment-protected speech.
But they certainly have the freedom to make that choice. Right?
They do. But that is why we, however, are calling on other companies who can provide service or who are sought out for service to provide it, not because they necessarily support WikiLeaks, but because they support free speech and want to work to preserve all of our rights to speak and to read online.
Maybe, Victor Davis Hanson, we should be talking, as one listener points out, more about the failure of the government to protect the data, although I've heard that maybe some positive things from the standpoint of some officials in the State Department that may come out of this is to have better security from their perspective or better secrecy or, for that matter, to help people understand just the difficulty of the work that they do.
Well, I agree. I mean, when somebody goes out to shop and he leaves his doors unlocked and then the thief comes in and robs him, he's culpable for being negligent, but it doesn't excuse what the thief did. So the State Department was negligent. The idea that you have somebody who's 22 years old that's called a military analyst downloading or uploading Lady Gaga and he has access to all these cables is insane. But it still doesn't excuse what Mr. Assange did. This is not new, though, when the caller talks about all this secrecy and corporate. This is the most transparent period in American history by far. World War II, these same issues came up. Battle of Midway, we had cracked the Japanese cold, and Mr. McCormick, the head of the Chicago Tribune, the day of the battle, printed that. And he was, you know, soundly criticized. And he ceased printing all of the information that led to the code breaking of the Japanese naval codes. Same thing with the ultra secrets. Journalists, people decided that they would not release that information, even though some of it was very damning, especially things like Churchill knowing in advance that Coventry was going to be bombed and made the decision not to let it be bombed and not warn people, 6,000 of whom would then die, because he thought the information would save lives later on. But this modernist notion, this therapeutic notion that everything has to be transparent or some, and you have to be absolutely perfectly transparent to be good, That's a very unique and very recent phenomenon.
Question for you, though, Victor Davis Hanson, from a listener named Michael, who says, let's not forget Scooter Libby and Dick Cheney leaking Ms. Palm's, Valerie Plame's identity. Is there a double standard here?
Well, first of all, Scooter Libby didn't leak it. I mean, he was charged and convicted of a convoluted story, but the person who leaked it was Richard Armitage, and nothing happened to him. And the question is, it's still the issue was never resolved. Was at the time she a covert agent or not? When Robert Novak got that information from Richard Armitage, nobody quite knows that. Whether she was on the line, technically not. We do know that the Washington Post thinks that the whole thing was sort of a charade, at least the movie version of it. And I've talked to Joe Wilson myself, and I would tend to agree after talking to him on one occasion. So I think that's a not a very good example at all.
And we go to Livermore. Richard, thank you for waiting. Join us.
Good morning. As always, a wonderful show. My question has been sort of touched on previously, but I want to ask it anyway. With the First Amendment, freedom of speech, and so forth, does that not also imply at least a tertiary sort of responsibility? If I say you're a jerk, aren't I responsible for that, for making that comment? Is there not some sort of responsibility attached to this?
Kevin Bankson.
Well, first off, calling someone a jerk is your opinion, and that's highly protected speech. But even more protected are facts, speaking the truth. And the First Amendment doesn't protect only journalists or only responsible journalists. Our Supreme Court Justice Douglas, many years ago in the Pentagon Papers case, put it, the fact that the liberty of the press may be abused by miscreant purveyors of scandal doesn't make the press's immunity against prior restraint any less necessary. Yes, free speech will be abused sometimes. That is the necessary cost of free speech. But in return, we get a vibrant marketplace of ideas based on information that we can understand and act on and have opinions on.
Well, here's a listener named Jason, speaking of jerks, as the last caller did. And Jason says, I'm not saying Jason is a jerk, by the way. Let me read the email and you'll get the sense of why I'm making that segue. He says, once again, we have the obvious distinction between having a right and how that right is exercised. Yes, WikiLeaks is just a billboard and they do not have an obligation to not publish information per se, but that is not the end of the discussion. I have a right to walk down the street and shout obscenities at little children, but if I did that, I'd be a thoughtless, stupid, mean-spirited jerk. Of course, this disclosure of information is damaging, even if not directly fatal. WikiLeaks does not have a moment of sanctimony here. It is a blank billboard. And as for its defenders, they're self-aggrandizing idiots if they think they're doing anyone a favor.
I'm not sure which ad hominem attack to respond to first.
Well, the analogy, it may be a little off to talk about, you know, screaming at children, obscenities and the like, but you get the essence of what he's saying here, I think.
I think so.
He's saying the distinction between having a right and how the right is exercised, mm-hmm. having a billboard and what you put on the
and
billboard.
And he has the right, and I support his
because
right.
Because you can doesn't
to
mean you
say
should. Right?
That what WikiLeaks is doing is irresponsible. I don't think you have to agree with WikiLeaks' actions to support its rights or to support the more general right of all of us to publish or read the material that's been leaked. I think it's worth noting that this story is not all about WikiLeaks at this point and certainly not all about Julian Assange. All of these cables are now in the hands of major newspapers across the country. And so I wish that we could focus the discussion more on the free speech debate over that information rather than on the particular tactics or personality of Julian Assange.
I think Declan wants in here, but first, Victor Davis Hanson, what about the protection of newspapers here and, you know,
That's a very good point, because we know that the New York Times was on record not publishing the so-called Climate Gate transcripts that were leaked through email because apparently they felt that it had been that information had been gotten through stealth and not through proper channels, and therefore they didn't want to publish it. The problem that the whole issue has is, of course, is that this is embarrassing to an establishment government organization and not some type of green movement that's anti-establishment, at least in the eyes of the leakers. And it's also more problematic because we're not talking about the Bush-Cheney administration that everybody in this type of activity likes to embarrass, but the embarrassment comes largely to a liberal Democratic administration, and it will have repercussions on perhaps their popularity and even their domestic agenda. And that raises an issue because you can see that already in the case of the New York Times and ClimateGate versus WikiLeaks, they're not consistent. And it leaves a suspicion to a lot of people that there's ideological concerns involved.
But the defense of the New York Times is that the information was already out. The Guardian had already published it, I believe.
On the case of ClimateGate?
No, I'm back to WikiLeaks again.
Oh, it was out on ClimateGate, too.
Yeah.
They chose not to get themselves involved because of matter and principle. But in this case, they were not consistent. And I think the only reason was ideological.
Declan McCullough.
Yeah, I mean, even the New York Times ombudsman will admit and has admitted that the New York Times has a point of view. But back to the WikiLeaks, there is the two points. I mean, the first is that Kevin cited the Pentagon Papers, but also in the Pentagon Papers, you have Supreme Court Justice Byron White saying that in certain circumstances, the publication of national defense information could subject media outlets to espionage prosecutions despite the First Amendment. So this gets us to who's a media organization or not. And this is an important point worth making. You have Senator Lieberman, who is the head of the Homeland Security Committee in the Senate, saying earlier this week, and I quote, the New York Times has committed at least an act of bad citizenship, and whether they've committed a crime, I think that bears very intensive inquiry by the Justice Department. So he's threatening a U.S.-based media organization for publishing classified information. And the State Department, the Pentagon, have in the last week tried very carefully to say, Assange is not a journalist. WikiLeaks is not a journalistic enterprise. But you have the senator who is, by the way, a founding member of the Global Internet Freedom Caucus, saying, "Oh, well, let's actually go beyond that and say that even the New York Times could be prosecuted."
Here's Peter, a listener in San Carlos, who says, "Julian Assange is my hero. Anybody who doesn't think there's censorship in this country better wake up. Visa, MasterCard, PayPal, and Amazon are perfectly happy to take your money to pay for porn. Political dissent, however, not so much. The claim is that what WikiLeaks did is illegal. Baloney. I have worked around classified material. Leaking that material to WikiLeaks would have been illegal. Them publishing it, however, would not be. Do your listeners know this? It's a pretty darn fundamental." Do you want to say something on that, Kevin Bankstrom?
That last bit of the comment is actually correct. It's a fundamental fact that the First Amendment, whatever the Espionage Act of 1917 says, the First Amendment as it's developed over the past 5 decades or so makes very clear that the innocent recipient of true political speech has a very strong right to publish it. I think that Senator Joe Lieberman's comments put aside that fact, which legal commentators of many stripes and indeed Congress's own research service, CRS, which we published a memo of theirs on our website at EFF.org just yesterday, recognize what the senator does not, which is a prosecution of a publisher for simply publishing information that it innocently received would be unprecedented, completely unprecedented, and would pose serious First Amendment problems. Also, in response to Declan's point about the Pentagon Papers and some of the justices in that case noting the possibility of an after-publication prosecution as opposed to a prior restraint, it's worth noting that several of the justices also, in reading the Espionage Act, felt that it did not apply to publication. And further, it's worth noting that in cases since the Pentagon Papers, they have made clear that the burden the government would have to meet to prosecute someone in this sort of situation is as high as that it would need to restrain their original speech.
But Kevin, you're making one very huge assumption, and this goes to what the caller said, that both you and the caller were assuming that WikiLeaks is just a conduit. They have an inbox, and the material just magically appeared in the inbox. That may not be the case. The Pentagon has claimed that WikiLeaks solicited this information from Bradley Manning. If that's true, then this would you defend that? Would you defend someone saying, "Oh yeah, please break the law, give me the information"? I'm not saying that happened. If it did, is that conspiracy or is that First Amendment speech?
I think that would be a very different issue. WikiLeaks, contrary to the Pentagon, has said that it did not solicit the information from Bradley Manning. But keeping in mind that this is more than just about WikiLeaks, as I keep saying, what about the New York Times? Would you say that the New York Times broke the law by receiving this information?
But they didn't solicit the information from Manning. They had no contact with him. They got it actually from the UK Guardian. They didn't even get it from WikiLeaks in the latest round. WikiLeaks was annoyed about their coverage. So the New York Times doesn't help you out in the case of conspiracy.
Well, let me actually go to you on this, Victor Davis Hanson. I mean, particularly with First Amendment protection here and burden of proof, how do you see it?
Well, I think it's a very gray line. The respondent kept using the word innocently, innocently, innocently. But if, in fact, certain newspapers have given a preconceived idea that they're going to publish particular information and that is known to WikiLeaks and that serves as incentive that people who would leak to them know that, in fact, they're going to become famous, they're going to have their word out, or they're not going to become famous, and that's all predicated on having this sort of audience, then they're more than a conduit. In other words, they're deliberately sending signals to Mr. Assange that they are willing and able to help him provide the incentive so people might leak. And in the case of the New York Times, we don't seem to have a consistent policy. We do seem to think that if it involves the government's confidentiality, then it will be more likely than not to leak it, and Mr. Assange will know that, and then people will be more likely to leak to him. That seems to be a little bit more complicit than the word innocently.
Well, also, forgive me if I'm sounding naive here, but can't you be prosecuted as a civilian for possessing stolen property?
I think you should. And again, this is all academic. we're all sitting in very comfortable places talking about it. Some it's, you know, it's kind of amusing, the blonde that's with Gaddafi, Hillary Clinton spying on you, and yeah, that's fine.
I think there were four blondes with Gaddafi, just for the record.
Yeah, well, we don't know the ramifications of all of these thousands of lies. We do know there's a lot of human rights organizations that have petitioned not to release the names of people who have tried to partner with NATO coalition forces in Afghanistan, for example. These are people who do things like want to help build a clinic, or they want to have a neighborhood watch society in a village in Afghanistan, and they become people who the NATO forces can work with. And then if their information is released, believe me, we're not going to know what happens to them. They're just going to be another figure of somebody who got blown up in Afghanistan. But there's a greater likelihood than not that they're at more risk now. The same thing about future diplomatic we don't know what diplomatic breakthrough or what diplomatic breakthrough will not happen, but we can be sure that the mother's milk of diplomacy is confidentiality. It's that way with everything, with what you do, with what I do, with what your listeners do, what law firms do, what media do. And this sudden idea that the government has to meet a particular standard of absolute honesty and candor that nobody else in society abides by, and especially not WikiLeaks. I would love to see the internal email communications between the WikiLeaks board and Mr. Assange, or Mr. Assange's own trial on supposed sexual misconduct, all of those cables back and forth, maybe his communication with his girlfriends. We need the whole picture of Mr. Assange in this way of thinking, and we can make a decision on whether he's moral or not. Can we do that? Of course we can. But he applies a standard that not only is not consistent throughout society, but it's not consistent with his own life.
Well, that's going to have to bring things to the conclusion here, but it has been certainly a most illuminating hour, and I want to thank all of those who participated in this hour. Thanks to you, Victor Davis Hanson. Victor Davis Hanson, senior fellow at Hoover Institution at Stanford and author of The Father of Us All, War and History, Ancient and Modern. We were also joined by Niles Gardner of the Heritage Foundation, and here in studio by Kevin Bankston from the Electronic Frontier Foundation and Declan McCullough, who is chief political correspondent for CNET. Thanks to you, our listeners. Wouldn't be here without you, and we are appreciative of your listenership. We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to also thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Thanks also to our interns, and it's last day for Elena Cavani. We wish her well and hope she goes on to brighter things and appreciate her service here with us in your public radio station, KQED. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.